Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, a very warm welcome to Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio. Tech Talk, of course, your regular source of accessible technology, news, interviews and information that we hope you can use. And of course, Tech Talk, it's your programme and we would be delighted to hear from you. So do get in touch with any comments, questions or suggestions of items you'd like to hear on the programme. You can do that by email to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Coming up this time on Tech Talk, we'll be hearing about what's new with In Your Pocket. We'll be talking with Sandra Geyer, who is a blind singer and creative. And we'll also be learning about how to do video banking from RNIB's Technology for Life team. Joining me as ever are our co-hosts, Tasneem Arshad and Callum Stoneman. Welcome in to you both. Any of that tickle your fancy, Taz?
Sounds good to me. I'm particularly interested in the In Your Pocket, so yeah.
Yeah, it's a sort of standalone device that you can use for accessing all sorts of content. So we'll be learning about that in a second. Callum, how about you?
Video banking is the one that I'm looking forward to. I think, you know, if it saves you the trip of having to go in branch, and I know that's where a lot of banks are going nowadays. But yeah, from a blind person's point of view, that could be a bit tough. So we're looking forward to hearing more about that.
Okay, so plenty to look forward to on this edition of Tech Talk. Now, as you know, there are a number of ways to listen to RNIB Connect Radio. You can tune in on Freeview, channel 730, or you can find us on FM in Glasgow, or perhaps join us via your smart speaker or smartphone. But did you know RNIB Connect Radio is also available via In Your Pocket from RealSam? And joining us is Louise Humphreys, who is the UK country manager. Welcome to Tech Talk, Louise. Good to have you with us. Just remind everyone what the kind of the unique selling point really is of your device.
Hi, Dave, and thanks for having me on. So In Your Pocket really is designed to be the smartphone for blind and partially sighted people who perhaps have struggled with mainstream devices. So devices that are perhaps controlled through menus, through the use of apps, and perhaps they're just that little bit more complex. So as we're fully voice controlled, we aim to, I guess, be in that lane where we offer lots of different features, but they're easy to use and you can do it all by voice.
When you say fully voice controlled, how does that compare with other voice control systems that we might be familiar with? I'm thinking about Lady A and, you know, what can you do with In Your Pocket that perhaps might be challenging elsewhere?
Yeah, so I guess the idea behind RealSam as an organisation is that we are actually a voice dialogue organisation. So the legacy behind In Your Pocket was that we were a voice business that built a relationship with the RNIB, who had a need to be able to share their content and materials to the blind community in the UK. And then the third part of the partnership was O2 to bring the phone element together. So the reason for that background is to let you know really that at our core, we're a voice organisation. And so what we specialise in is conversations through voice. Now, through In Your Pocket, you can have a dialogue. And what I mean by dialogue is that it's not just a single question with a single response. You can have quite a detailed interaction where you can be using that to search through menus of information to, I guess, drill down within a catalogue of books, for example, or newspapers, and ask clarifying questions. It also means that if you're using the device to do something, let's say you are listening to a book and your phone rings, the phone will announce through voice that your phone is ringing with who it is that's ringing. You can take that call, but you can also then return to where you were in the previous thing that you were doing. You don't get cut off. So I suppose with some of those other systems or tools that you spoke about, the A1 and the S1, quite often it's a single interaction. So I suppose our USP is that we allow multiple interactions and multiple dialogues at the same time.
Yeah, because you're not the only sort of specialist device, I guess, on the market. There are a couple of others around. Some of them have got buttons. And if people are looking at this, what should they be kind of looking out for?
Yeah, I guess for us at our core, we've really been able to build on this book reader side of the product, and that allows us to have 5 libraries on the product and over 100,000 titles. And as I said, that kind of intelligent search that is all about using voice is one of the things that we believe we do well. We also don't just move you out into an Android app and use the standard accessibility features of the core handset, which is maybe what you find sometimes with the other products. We do end-to-end control that experience through voice. So we only bring solutions into In Your Pocket that we believe we can really ensure they are fully voice accessible. So I know some of the other products, they perhaps just guide you to an external interface, whereas what we do is end-to-end control that experience through voice. It also has, I guess, the reverse of that means that we don't have lots and lots and lots of features. So we don't allow people to go in and download their own apps. We haven't got social media on there right now. And that is because we really do see it as fundamentally important that we are providing that voice first experience that is truly accessible. So that, I guess that's what I would say is the key difference, that the book reading side is one of our core skills, and then the ability to stay within that voice environment.
You make a really important point there, and I liken it to being thrown off an accessibility cliff. Like, everything's going really well and is easy to use, and then suddenly you get dumped off in a third-party application that works really differently, and suddenly you've got to start learning how to use that again. So I think that is a massive consideration. Talk us through the setup process, Louise. What happens when you receive In Your Pocket? You get the box, you take it out of the box. It feels a bit like a smartphone. There's a big touch screen. There are some buttons around the edge. What happens?
Everybody who receives their phone, they will have chosen up front to either receive it with an O2 contract as part of it or to have bought the handset outright. And the key differences there are the first option would come with a SIM card installed that would have a tariff attached to it, and essentially you could turn it on and it will work straight away. The second option, if you've chosen to buy it without the O2 plan attached because perhaps you've already got a SIM card that you like, or the signal in that area maybe isn't quite as strong. Certain parts of the sort of extreme periphery of the UK maybe don't always have a strong mobile signal. The phone will arrive with the user guide built into it. Obviously, you'll get a charger and headphones, lanyards, all of that kind of stuff. Within the first 24 hours, we aim to make contact with the customer through our customer service team that are based in the UK. And we make sure that every customer gets at least 1 hour, ideally 2, of one-to-one support to help them get set up. Because we know that even though we are, we believe, an easy-to-use product, everybody needs a little bit of support when you get something new. It doesn't matter who you are or you know what it is that you've bought. You're always going to need maybe a little bit of guidance. So we aim to help everybody get connected to their home Wi-Fi. Again, that can be done by voice, but it's not always super easy for somebody to navigate as their first thing they want to do. So we'll guide somebody through getting connected to their Wi-Fi, and we'll typically show them on that first call how to enter some contacts and how to navigate key features, really, like making a phone call, sending a message, and perhaps finding R&IB Connect Radio, let's say. That's one of the things that you can do. So that will be a session that allows people to really just find their feet. And then around a week, maybe 2 weeks later, we'll schedule another call. And by that point, we're hoping that somebody has started to use the phone. They've felt confident in the things we've initially shown them, but perhaps they're ready to learn a bit more, or perhaps they've got clarifying questions that they want to ask. So we give people 60 days when they first get the phone to try it and hopefully love it, but if they don't, then they've got 60 days in which they can return it. But during that period, we're there providing one-to-one support as people need. We also have a online customer portal, which is really great for loved ones to be able to use as well. So it's password protected, unique to the individual account, but it allows loved ones to do things like add contacts in bulk to the phone, which will then get pushed into the handset, as well as searching for the catalogue of entertainment content, so you can find out what books are available through RNIB, radio stations, the podcasts we have, all of that kind of great stuff. So if you're supporting a loved one, you may want to use our web interface to find some tips and tricks and ideas yourself. And of course, the end user customer can access their website themselves as well. It is a fully accessible site.
Loads of support there, really exciting, particularly around setup. And that's so important, that home Wi-Fi experience can be really tricky. You mentioned your voice first. How do you actually use that then? Do you say, hey, in your pocket? Or, you know, how do you make sure that the device is listening? What sorts of things can you say to it and what can you expect in reply?
Yeah, so it isn't always listening. I guess that's another factor. It's not waiting for you to say a trigger word as such. You are always going to need to either tap the screen on the latest version or a button on the side. And really that comes down to user preference, which one you prefer. And then you'll hear a beep. And essentially then you can ask your question. And while it is processing what it is you've asked, you'll hear a ticking sound, so you'll know that it's actually doing something. And it'll just be for a couple of seconds, but let's say you've said, read me the Guardian, which is a command that you can use. And that will straight away bring up the headlines from today's Guardian newspaper, and then you can filter through. And equally, you can do that for any of the commands. So you just press the button on the front or the side and say what it is you're looking for. And there's a series of, I guess, key phrases that you would use to access each of the content areas within the device. So it can be make a phone call, send a message, add a contact, what's the weather, set a reminder. And we take people through all of this in those introductory calls, but also built within the device is a user guide broken down into sections. And within each section of that user guide, you get mini tutorials, essentially, of how to navigate those key settings and what the phrases are.
How do you get to that, Louise? Can I just say help?
So you just say user guide. Yeah, you just press the button and say user guide, and then you can navigate within the user guide to each of the key settings. Alternatively, we do have a sighted menu on in your pocket as well. So if you wanted to navigate that, we ask you to draw a big L down the left-hand side of the screen across to the right, and that sighted menu is voice enabled. So you run your finger down the screen and the third one down is user guide. And then again, you can navigate the user guide just by using your finger across the screen to get to each of the sections with each of those key instructions.
Excellent. What's next? I mean, you've got talking books in there. You've got The Guardian, I think you said, and other newspapers, presumably as well. I know you can say play RNIB Connect Radio. I did that the other day and it worked really well. Anything else you want to highlight in terms of content that you have curated?
Well, we've got everything from the RNIB. So we've got the RNIB talking books and the RNIB news agent. So anything that people love listening to through there is available. We partner also with Calibre Audio, so we have their books, and Torch Trust, a Christian library, and then two others. So that brings the book library really up to over 100,000 sources. As you mentioned, national and local radio stations, national and local newspapers. And what we're working on improving right now is our podcast feed. So we have podcasts from all over the world, things like the Hadley Institute from the Blind, the National Public Radio from the US, obviously all of the RNIB, BBC content. But what we're trying to do is just improve some of the search around podcasting, because podcasting's obviously exploded in the last couple of years. And right now you'd need to search by the title of a podcast, whereas, for example, you might know the name of the host or the celebrity. You might know the month that you want to listen to the podcast from. So that's one of the things we're working on behind the scenes, trying to ensure that, I guess, we're keeping up with so much of the innovation that's happened in that podcasting space, and that our podcasting offer represents what our customers and our users are increasingly asking for. So that's good. We're also working on a feature called Voice Notes, and we're just testing that right now, which will enable people to record themselves little reminders and voice memos, which again has come through customer feedback that people would really love that just ability to set themselves a quick reminder and a quick note. So that's great. And I suppose the big one for us is we're always looking at how can we bring in some of these big key features like email into the piece. So that's one that we're working on behind the scenes, so that we can ensure that we're offering again, that fully accessible offer to bring email onto Pocket.
Fantastic. Well, that is so exciting that there's so much there in terms of information and entertainment, and then you've got the communication with the phone, and I guess you can send messages as well. And you've just been really careful and considered about how you include other features and functions going forward to make sure that you keep that consistent, accessible experience. So that's really good to hear. And the voice memos thing, hopefully we'll get some people recording feedback for us here at Tech Talk and maybe sending in those voice recordings. That would be amazing. Louise, I understand you've got a bit of an offer for RNIB Connect Radio listeners.
We'd love to offer RNIB Connect listeners a discount on Pocket if they would like to give us a try. So we're offering a £2 per month discount on the 2-year plan. So Pocket, a brand new version, is £26.99 a month for a 2-year contract. That gives you the Samsung X-Cover 5 handset, obviously all of the entertainment features that we spoke about today, and unlimited calls and texts within the UK and 3 gigabytes of data. So we'll be bringing that down to £24.99 a month for 2 years for Connect Radio customers, and they can just call into our customer support line on 01733 514 612, mention that they heard this offer on this show, and we'd be happy to organise that for you.
Fantastic. Well, Louise Humphreys, UK Country Manager for Real Sam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
You're listening to Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, a voice familiar to many Connect Radio listeners is that of Sandra Geyer. Sandra was born in Zambia, is a visually impaired soprano singer, radio presenter, of course, voiceover artist, presents the Music Box programme here on Connect Radio, which, of course, is award-winning. So we should say the award-winning Music Box programme has appeared in numerous TV ads and also made many other radio appearances, including on BBC Radio 3. Hello, Sandra. A very warm welcome in. I'm sure I've missed a ton of stuff there, but you can fill me in as we go along.
It's nice to be on the show. I've been a listener for quite some time, so glad it's back on air.
So let's go right back to the beginning then. As a child, were you always a natural performer?
Yes, definitely. Making an exhibition of myself, you know what performers are like. So I was born sighted and had cataracts, and then I'm the Braillist you know today through that. And I was into all sorts of music when I was very little, and moved house a couple of times, had a singing teacher who discovered my soprano voice, as it were, and really enjoyed singing that way, because prior to that I was a fairly ordinary vocalist, if you will, gospel music, Disney, all that sort of thing. And then really enjoyed operatic singing, and I trained at the Royal College of Music as a singer. I studied composition and piano as well. Braille music, they had that written down as if it were a fourth study, as in another instrument. So I reckon they probably thought it was that complicated. It needed that level of kudos.
This is Tech Talk, and we should talk about technology. What are some of your earliest memories, Sandra, of technology that you used?
My earliest was the talking calculator I got when I was 6, and I'm in my 30s now and it's still going.
Oh, one of the sharp ones, the ones with the slidey buttons on the side, the male voice, that one, or is it something different?
It was a female voice. It's still alive. Technically Perkins Braillet is kind of tech. I mean, I've heard a pen and paper described as technology, and
it's an important question, isn't it? When is technology technology? And we talk a lot about high technology on this program, you know, and apps and all that kind of stuff. But you are absolutely right that, of course, the Perkins Braille is technology. A talking calculator is technology. When you learned Braille, I imagine initially that was with a Perkins and paper. Do you remember your first?
Yes. I'm far too young for the slate and stylus, although I do have one. I can write my name-ish. It's the whole not being able to read what I'm writing while I'm writing it that puts me off doing that. So yeah, I'm team Perkins, and I use I've got an embosser and various computer gizmos. But to carry on with low tech, I love the Dymo gun. That is my friend for Christmas cards and birthday cards and things, and sighted people really like it because they seem to think, I don't know why, that I'm sitting there physically punching each individual dot. Most of the time, I don't bother to disillusion them about that.
The Dymo labeler, a very important device. No batteries, of course, but a great way for sighted people to create small amounts of Braille that you can use for labeling and greetings cards and all that stuff. What tools did you use to learn Braille?
Perkins Brailler, books. So hard copy books, not the electronic ones we're used to now because they didn't exist back then. I think Douglas Adams invented them in Hitchhiker's Guide. And now we look back and you think, oh, that's a Kindle.
How did your career get started, Sandra?
It got started by me performing a lot, people hearing me and other people hiring me to perform for their events. So that's how it grew organically. The website and agency representation and all those kinds of things came much later, well after I left school. So I was a soloist from about the age of 6, and I was working, and I mean paid work, from my teens in school. So I was the one sloping off 5 or 10 minutes early, tuts all around the room because she's going off somewhere to be on stage. And then when I left school, then I could really concentrate properly on it. So it makes me laugh when I read my CV and there's a 2-year gap and I'm screaming to myself, like, I was doing A-levels. I could do everything all the time. So when I left school, then after I trained at the Royal College of Music and studied with different teachers, including somebody who worked at the English National Opera, I got some agency representation. And my agency is one that works exclusively with disabled artists. So creating mainstream opportunities for disabled artists, that kind of thing. Some people would choose not to do that, which is to go with an agency that represents everybody. I just feel more comfortable in a disabled people agency because there are some disabled people who can do both. I can't pass myself off as sighted. I mean, I can do some interesting things on stage because the people are quite far away from me. So I'm good at turning my head to follow whatever limb movements. So it looks like I'm looking at this or tracking that, and it's all in the head movements. But with close up things like on telly, you really can't get away with that sort of thing. So I'm a blind person. I play blind characters on radio and in audio dramas, which I've been in, and voiceover and cartoons. Then there's a bit more scope to play just about anything or anyone, adults, children.
You mentioned your singing and, of course, being involved in audio dramas, and you've done adverts and all sorts of bits and pieces. How do you approach learning a new piece of music or learning your lines for a TV or a radio performance?
I use Braille, so I read it. And depending on what the production is, I will memorize from that. But in order to get it to that point, I would have a Word document, not a PDF, because I'm sure you know that not all PDFs are created equal. And it's rather tiresome trying to explain to sighted colleagues that images of text are not actually text. They're just images. That's why it's really great to have agency representation, because then you can just let them discuss that sort of thing with employers and contractors. Like, she needs a Word document. So I have a Word document. Then I reformat it to make it a bit more friendly to me and workable in Braille. So take out the acres of blank lines that are there to make it look nice. I sometimes have help from somebody sighted to see if there's anything that hasn't come out well, like bolds and italics and various things. And sometimes I'll just change them to capital letters so it's quicker to grasp. So after I've done all that, then it'll go into Duxbury Tech. And my embosser and I will have a nice hard copy of it. Also have a backup copy on electronic braille on my Braille Note Touch, and I do that through a flash drive. It can stay in Word for that because it can cope with Word and BRF, which I like. And BRF is what I like for Braille music. So let's say I'm in a production and I have long enough to get it transcribed into Braille music, because unlike print, where it takes seconds to basically press emboss, with music notation, with stave notation, it is very pictorial in print. Braille music is linear, it's left to right, but in print, if you have one note higher than another, it will appear higher than the other on the actual page. So it takes quite a lot of reformatting, and I use a number of Braille music transcribers who are sighted, although I have heard of one or two blind people doing it, but even they will have a sighted army doing the proofing. So I have that, and then they will send it back to me in BRF. If I'm working with somebody in the UK, then they will send me a hard copy through the post, and it's much easier to just turn the pages and there's nothing to worry about crashing or saving things. But assuming I'm working with somebody overseas, so I have a few people I work with in America for that, because you can't rely on just one person because they're all busy working on various different contracts of different lengths. So I have quite a few in the wings. So I'll receive the BRF slash hard copy. If it's a BRF, then I might emboss it myself, or if it's too big a file to lift, then I will just cut and paste the relevant bits and make that a hard copy. Or if it's something where the composer is still alive, because I've been in contemporary productions like that and things are chopping and changing a lot anyway, then I will leave it as an electronic file and add to it myself.
As blind and partially sighted people, we have lots of ways to consume and create music. Tasneem, you like the streaming services for listening?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I generally use sort of Apple Music and that sort of thing, mainly listen to it on my iPhone. I just like the fact that it's on the move and, you know, you can listen to it anywhere, and that particularly works well for me.
So VoiceOver obviously works really well with Apple Music. And then do you also use voice control as well to ask Siri to play a particular song? Is that something that you do?
I don't actually do that. I prefer to just sort of skip through, swipe through, select, and then just kind of put it on a, you know, on a shuffle if I want to do that or that sort of thing. But I guess if you wanted to use voice control, that would be another option for people as well.
Yeah, and of course you can use Apple Music on your smart speaker as well. But it sounds like Tasneem's a browser, Callum, enjoys browsing through music and selecting a track. How about yourself? Do you listen to a lot of music? Do you create music?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I pretty much only use Siri to control my music, to be honest. And sometimes I'll use Lady A as well, you know, and they both tie into my Apple Music. I don't really create music as such. I mean, I do kind of some audio editing for, you know, these recordings and stuff. But a friend of mine is a musician. He absolutely loves the Mac for this because you've got GarageBand built in, which is fairly accessible. As I said, he loves Logic. That's his tool of choice, and obviously that's an Apple product and accessible with VoiceOver. So there's a lot out there, and there's a lot on Windows as well. You know, I hear a lot about Pro Tools. Apparently I think people really love that, a bit more on the premium side. But I did used to play piano a few years ago while I was in school. I did music GCSE, so I did piano for a bit, and I did all right at it, but I had to kind of just memorize it. I did occasionally get some Braille music, but the VI staff in my school, they didn't really know Braille music that well, so I never really sort of learnt to read it. And I think if I'd have had an accessible way of finding music and being able to read music, I probably would have continued it, to be honest, because I did enjoy it. So I don't know if either of you know about accessible ways of reading music.
Yeah, so of course Braille music is an option. There is a bit of a learning curve there when it comes to Braille music. And of course the big issue, I guess, for Braille music is that you can't read and play at the same time. Like you, Callum, I enjoy bothering the occasional piano. I can't walk past a piano without having a little play. And I bought myself a digital piano during the first lockdown and went online looking for courses and lessons where I could improve my playing. I don't really perform, but it's really more for my own amusement and to unwind. And we've got an acoustic piano in the living room, but I don't think my family appreciate my practicing at all hours. So I did a bit of research and I managed to find a digital piano. I bought a Yamaha P125, which sounds more like a train than a piano. But the great thing about that is it doesn't have any kind of screen on it. It's all push buttons and they're tactile buttons. There's no touchscreen involved. It just has a few piano sounds and, you know, a couple of organs and strings and things. It's not really a synthesizer as such. It's just for piano, so it's got 88 weighted keys. And then in terms of some of those online services, I like HD Piano, Piano with Johnny, Piano Groove, and these are websites that you can go along to and sign up, and they work really well with screen readers, and they have video lessons that you can access where, you know, a professional teacher will walk you through step by step how to play a jazz standard or learn a new style of music. Have you ever thought about taking up a musical instrument, Tasneem?
Well, I dabbled in it at college, you know, kind of drums, saxophone, violin, you know, a few different clarinets. But yeah, it's not really for me, but I really admire people who actually play instruments because I think it's just an incredible skill. And I actually wonder whether, because you've mentioned about some piano, you know, websites and things being accessible, but does that actually apply to other musical instruments as well? Do either of you know?
That's a good question. I don't. I haven't looked into that. How about you, Callum?
No, I'm not sure. I haven't looked into that either. But I know this is a bit of a difference from the piano. My wife used to play the tuba in a band a few years ago, so she's trying to get me into that now. She's trying to convince me to learn the tuba. I've got one got one here behind me. And no, I'm not going to play a bit on air because I can't. But no.
I've got to send a strongly worded email to our producer to ask him to insert tuba sound at this point. Well, fantastic, guys. If you have accessible ways of consuming or creating music, we'd love to hear about those here at Tech Talk. Drop us a line, techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
Have you ever struggled with going into branch in person to complete your banking? Here's Dave talking to Madeline Bloom about an alternative strategy that you may wish to consider with video banking.
Now, I remember the days when the main way for us as blind and partially sighted people to access our banking was to go into the branch and actually talk to somebody face to face. And then, of course, came telephone banking, where you could dial an automated system and you would press 1 to hear your balance and 2 to make a transfer and all that kind of thing. Well, things have moved on, of course, and many banks and building societies have an app that you can install onto your smartphone, and this will let you independently access your bank accounts. However, if you need human assistance, there is now another way. Madeline Bloom joins us from RNIB's Technology for Life team to explain about video banking. Video banking, Madeline, I didn't even know this was a thing.
Oh, I didn't know either, Dave, until I tried it out. I was in a situation that made it still quite difficult for us lot to go into a bank because we were in a semi-lockdown England, really, at the time. And as you all know, I've got a couple of children and one of them wanted to have their own bank accounts and kept nudging me, "Mummy, when can we go to the bank?" And I had to explain that the banks were not open for us at the moment, and even though you can book appointments, they would not be for a long while. And then I was in my banking app and I found out there is this button and it says request a video banking appointment, and I thought, wow, what is this? And if I can do this, can I do this as a blind person? I think frustration got the better of me and I thought, well, you can only lose, just try it. It then asked me to download another app that's a video banking app for my bank. And I did that, and it automatically hooked up with my bank, so there was no logging in required. Only via my normal banking app, I needed to confirm that I wanted to use video banking. So I knew I wanted to do this video banking thing, and I went into the app, and it sort of told me I'm in a queue. It told me I'm so and so many people are in ahead of me. And then there was the moment where it connected me to a banker. Of course, this went wrong a few times because the banker couldn't see me and put the phone down. And I then had to do it again and hold the phone slightly different. And there was some issue at the time, technically, you know, with them as well. It was very new. But needless to say, we got to speak to one another, and we actually got to do what we had to do via video banking. And it's, you don't need to do it for all the appointments, but it's important for appointments where the banker needs to see your proof of ID or your proof of address, and they need to sort of confirm that with yourself. My message to you, blind and partially sighted people just like me out there listening to this, is just give it a go. Don't be shy. Some of your banks now offer this service. Barclays, NatWest, and the Royal Bank of Scotland are free to name here. Barclays started the whole thing off, but the others followed suit. And don't be scared and don't be shy. When you're feeling a bit insecure, whether you want to go out to the bank or maybe just getting there is a bit difficult at the moment, try video banking, because that's easy, it's comfortable, and you definitely get the job done.
So you require the app to already be set up. So you need to perhaps already have an account and have your banking app up and running before you can do video banking. Is that correct?
Yes, most definitely, Dave. You need your account. You need your account logins for your app. And ideally, please have your app installed and ready to use. And in your app, you can click probably on an option to, you know, install the video banking component, or go into your App Store or Google Store and find out whether you can get some video app for your bank to install this and make this process a lot easier.
Right. So for you then, which bank was this with, the one you tried?
For me, this was Barclays. And
right. And so within the Barclays app, did you have to download a separate app to do the video part then?
Or I did.
Could you do it? Right, so there's a second app then that will download to your device, and I assume that's a free app.
It is, yes, most definitely.
Yeah, and so then you press the button in your Barclays app, it'll download the video app, and then you have to sign into that, presumably, and then it will put you in the queue to connect with, you know, somebody in the bank.
Exactly, but you are all the way through, you're guided, you know what you have to do, all your instructions are on your smartphone screen. And as I said to you, when you are going into the video call procedure, it will say you have 5 people ahead of you, 4 people ahead of you, so you know where you are in the queue.
You said that the motivation for you to do this was because you wanted to open an account for one of your children, and presumably you had to provide, you know, identification and things like that, hence the video call. Is there a sort of a set list of things that you can do when you call the video banking, or will they pretty much help you with anything? Is it like going into the branch, or do you have to kind of choose from a fixed list of options?
No, it is like going into the branch, but you don't visit the branch, you do it all via video banking.
Right. And then when you have connected to your person in the bank, I mean, how aware are they of people with disabilities? You know, that it might be somebody blind calling them, or somebody with another disability, perhaps.
Do you know, Dave, I think this was never an issue. I did say that because I thought it was only fair to say that because, you know, to my defense, I might not have held the phone always.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and it just makes it, for me, I thought that it was fair to say, you know, I'm actually a visually impaired customer, but you shouldn't have any issues because I don't need to see you, I can hear you, but, and you know, as long as you can see me. Later on, it became important because they sent me a file that I needed to agree to, and I had to say that I'm using my screen reader, and I then connected my AirPods in order to see the file that I needed to agree to and then upload it again. And that also was no problem. So it sounds complicated, but please, it really isn't complicated.
So you mentioned Barclays. They're not alone now. They were one of the first, perhaps, to offer this, mm-hmm. but there are other banks that also provide video assistance.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, NatWest Banking and Royal Bank of Scotland are two of them that also provide you with video banking. And I'm sure, you know, there are a lot more. I know that Monzo is also doing a lot with video banking. So don't be shy to try for video banking with your banking app as well.
It would be fantastic to see a service like this coming to a device like the Alexa Show, because clearly on there, on the Echo Show, you could perhaps do the whole thing with your voice.
Yeah, that would be nice, definitely.
Well, that would certainly help those people who find smartphones difficult.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Excellent. Well, if people want to know more about accessible banking or different ways in which we can access our banking information, whether that be through an app or a video link or even just help with a banking website, is that something that Technology for Life can support?
Yes, most definitely. So please, if you want to talk to us about this some more, don't shy away. Just get in touch with us via the helpline of RNIB 0303 123 9999 and ask for Technology for Life.
Yeah, and important to emphasise that the Technology for Life team will never ask you for your password or confidential information. So if anybody asks you for that information, then they're probably not from RNIB.
Exactly.
All right. Madeline Bloom from RNIB Technology for Life. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've had an email come flooding in from Maxine Ingram, and Maxine wants to know, when using FaceTime on the Mac with VoiceOver, how do you go about answering the call? Maxine's feeling a bit frustrated and always has to get the other party to start and stop the call, which can be difficult. Callum Stoneman might have the answer.
Yeah, I get the frustration, and to be honest, FaceTime on the Mac isn't as accessible as you'd think, unfortunately. So yeah, answering the call is a bit of a lucky guess, really. The best way that I've found to do it is when you hear the call coming in, sometimes you can sort of command tab over to FaceTime, and even if you don't have FaceTime open at the time, it should pop up when the call comes in. And from there, you just use your VO left and right arrow keys, so Control, Option, and either left or right, and then you should find the answer button. But that doesn't always work. So the other option is to, again, when you hear the call coming in, press Control, Option, O to get to the notification center. And the first thing there should be the notification from FaceTime. And if you interact with that, then there should be the accept and decline buttons on there as well. So it's a little bit fiddly, but yeah, that's how you do it. And it's not very consistent, unfortunately.
Okay.
I wonder, Callum, if somebody is using a particular function quite a lot, like the FaceTime answering and making calls, if the button is always in the same place, is there a way of marking that on the screen so you know to go straight to it after you've performed the command?
Sort of, yeah. And in theory, there is a way that should work for this. So you can set hotspots using VoiceOver. You could set Control Option 1, for example, to always go to the answer button, which I tested out as well. But for some reason, although it puts the VoiceOver focus on the button, when you kind of do your VO space to click it, it doesn't actually click it. It clicks where you were before. So, you know, let's say you were on a link on a web page, and a call comes in, you could press VO1 and it would say, you know, accept button. But when you clicked it, it would click that link that you were previously on. So again, yeah, in theory, that should work. And I'm not really sure why it doesn't. I think that's one to mention to Apple about, really. That's a bit of a strange one.
For people like me who need to keep it really simple, Callum, could I just plug in my Apple earphones and then squeeze the button? Would that answer the call?
Potentially, yeah. I haven't tried that, to be honest. That's a good thought. But yeah, I mean, again, in theory, yeah, that could work. I'll test that out, actually. You've got me wondering now.
Thank you very much, both. Well, let us know how you get on, Maxine, and we hope that you have a bit more joy with those FaceTime calls. And if you've got a question, we'll have a stab. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. We look forward to hearing from you.
Here's Dave continuing his discussion with Sandra Geyer to learn more about how she uses technology to be creative with music.
What role did technology play in terms of your career development? Were there particular websites that you used?
I think the most difficult one was creating my own website, and the internet wasn't as widespread in the sense that everyone and anyone was surgically attached to it. This is going back to the noughties, and it was a bit more novel to have a website back then. And I remember being quite stressed about it. And my mom was saying to me at the time, there's no point being stressed. It's a leaflet and a cassette tape. I once have thought of it like that. I was like, well, I've read lots of leaflets and I've got loads of cassettes. I could do this. The whole electronic thing is just a by the by. It's the same things. I just need to transmogrify and put it on the internet. But there are different websites. I was steeped in them for schooling and research when I was training as a music student and studying and all those sorts of things. But one thing I do have a soft spot for is VSTs, so synthesized instruments. And technology plays an awfully big part in that, accessible tech, I should say, because there are various keyboards like talking keyboards, as in keyboards with talking menus on. So because it's quite difficult if there's no speech feedback to select the different noises that you want to then layer a track. So that's what I use for that. And I'm rather glued to the internet for information about that, not just purchasing things like that, but also different visual impaired focused groups, asking questions from people who have been doing this for 1,000 years versus me, who's just discovered it in the last 5 or 6 years. And hardware is something that I prefer from a performance point of view. So I'm talking to you through a Neumann microphone. That's still tech, even though it isn't app driven. I much prefer with the recording equipment, the knobs and dials approach and outboard gear rather than plugins for everything. So for example, I've got a preamp with input and output gain on knobs and dials, sound card knobs and dials, and I've got some EQ equipment, and you could have plugins for it all, but I much prefer to do it by ear, as in listen to something, turn a knob up or down or slider, rather than do number crunching in an app.
And what packages do you use? It sounds like you've got a bit of a home studio going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what software packages would you be using?
I keep software to a minimum. So I'm using Audacity today on my full-scale audio production, music production computer, which is desktop. I use Sonar, and I'm using Sonar 8.5, which is a million years old. I think I got it in 2010 or 2012 or something. It was the last accessible version of Sonar, and I think it's gone through a major rebrand since then, so I don't think it's even called that anymore. There are some good accessible ideas on there, but if people still want the old version, they can go to raisedbar.net to get info about that. And that is my DAW, my digital audio workstation. So on a very basic level, there's no point having a sound card and a microphone and things if there's nothing to capture that stuff with. So that's what that bit is for. And then, as I said, all the hardware to add all the effects on top of it. Other software, well, my VSTs, my synthesizers, and the keyboards, although are hardware, the self-voicing element, you could say, is tech. They're from Native Instruments, which have also gone through some rebranding recently.
If I booked you to come and perform at an event, how would you prepare?
I'm going to be extremely difficult and say it really depends on the circumstances. Sometimes people give me quite a bit of leeway and just get me to pick whatever it is, or they'll give me the theme and then I will find music appropriate to the theme. It would be a mixture of learning it by ear / braille. depending on how difficult it was. So if it was a seriously atonal piece, so something with no discernible tune and rhythm and pitch center, then I would need to read that. So I would send the stave notation or print music off to whoever was currently available, get them to transcribe it, get it back, read it, memorize it, perform it on stage.
And when you're doing your voiceover work or presenting on the radio, are you using your braille display for that, or hard copy, any other technology involved?
Well, with voiceover, I like to memorize. So I will read it certainly through the braille note touch or hard copy. So I'm currently away at the moment. I don't have access to my embosser at the Mo. So I do use my braille note for just about everything at this moment in time. So if you listen very carefully, my producer is an absolute wizard, because on the radio show, I certainly do not memorize that. I sit there and read and present. But if you listen very carefully, you can hear the odd click, but you won't hear too many, because as I said, my producer is really good at his EQing.
Fantastic. You mentioned your website. Did you create that yourself, or did you go out and get someone to kind of help with that a little bit?
Definitely cited web design team in that. I have no taste. So this colour with that colour blending in with this, that and the other, I would not have the foggiest of how to do that. I love the content. I mean, obviously the singing and acting and all of that is me doing it. It's all the clips and then some of the content I've generated. But yeah, all the images, I mean, the images of me, but the layout and all those kinds of things, cited web design team all the way.
It works very well with screen readers. Was that something that you specified right from the outset that was important to you, or was that more kind of a happy accident?
It actually wasn't. And the website that you see today is not the website that was the inaugural one, as it were, from about 2010. It was not as HTML based. And I found it quite difficult to work with, because back then I was writing a blog for it and all sorts of other things. And I was complaining rather loudly about how inaccessible it was. And the response was, well, it's not aimed at you, and it isn't. Fortunately, though, there are certain things about accessibility, like labeling graphics, like having HTML and being current, which also tie in with search engine optimization. And that's what I try and get across to other people, because I have done some consultancy work in the past. And while people do roll their eyes a bit about accessibility in terms of, oh, this is something else I've got to think about, not all of it is in law yet, but people don't really want to think about it because it seems far removed from them. So I wrote a course once and I called it Access to Money. See what I did there? So as in accessibility equals more money for you, because if you label the graphics, yes, it's easier for us. We actually know that you've been waxing lyrical about your best lettuce and potatoes and stuff, and then you have a photograph instead of unlabeled something. We know what that is. Well, so what? But actually, labeling graphics makes them more accessible to Google, and your website will appear further up the top, which means people are more likely to open it. And if you're a product or service-based business where you've got buy buttons on your pages, then that means more people are likely to open them and buy your stuff. Yay, accessibility. So that's what we need to do in order to, we need to sell it. Now, you could argue that we shouldn't need to. It's our right to be able to read this and that. But when you are looking at businesses and they're focused on the bottom line, you need to draw a clear straight line for them between helping us navigate their websites and more dosh for them. Now, my website's a bit different. It doesn't have buy buttons and stuff. It's my shop window. But I still like the accessibility side, and I still feel that search engine optimization is a key thing. So it is-ish a happy accident that it's accessible and legible, but there is some background to that, yes.
When advocating for digital accessibility, are you more a carrot or stick person. You mentioned obviously the financial incentives and
I think carrot works better than stick. I mean, stick is on the way. There's more legislation in the pipeline. A lot of what we are banging on about now, seemingly to ourselves, and it really isn't, it is going to be enshrined in EU law in 2025, and then businesses will be looking for people to implement that. So techies who are here and looking for work want to bear that in mind, that there will be jobs forthcoming because they will want experts in it, and there's no one more expert as the people who actually live it in their everyday lives rather than people. I was talking to somebody recently who said, I mentioned JAWS, and they said, oh yeah, I know that, I did that in a university module, and this is like 10 years ago, and I thought, well, yeah, okay, but I've had 20 years experience of using it. So that's what I'm saying, you know, I'm not a techie, but that's the kind of thing blind techies would want to think about.
It's almost ironic that you say you're not a techie, you've got this home studio and clearly a braille display, and you're clearly making
I'm not a professional techie, you know, I don't use tech directly, as in you know, web development and graphic design. Tech is a thread, a necessary thread in my life. I think it's a necessary thread for everyone who has our disability. You know, I suppose you would need it if you had a hearing loss or were a wheelchair user. But I think with us, it's every day. A lot of my stuff talks. I mean, I've talked a lot about Braille, but my phone talks, the microwave talks, the tape measure talks. It's endless.
I think that's probably a good place to leave it. Sandra Geyer, thank you so much for joining us on Tech Talk, and I hope you'll come back again very soon.
I will.
It's almost time for us to log off for another week. Don't forget to tune in next time when we'll be speaking with Karthik Kannan, one of the co-founders of Envision, and we'll be hearing about how to make those pesky PDFs more accessible with JAWS. Tasneem Arshad, thank you very much.
Thank you, and bye for now.
And Callum, we'll see you soon.
Thank you, see you soon.
And from me, Dave Williams, all the best. Bye for now.